Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, a True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora, published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. In the last episode, it has been about 6 weeks since Amy St. Lawrence's disappearance, and the Portland Police, Maine State Police, and Maine Warden Service were preparing for an extensive ground search for Amy's body on Saturday, December 8th. We resume Finding Amy on page 113, and this is episode 11. Chapter 11. On Saturday, December 8th, over 100 people, including the warden's overhead team, state and Portland police detectives, wardens, and about 45 Massar volunteers from units throughout the state, some of whom had slept Friday night in the gym at the Portland police station, assembled at a State Department of Transportation depot and state police headquarters off the main turnpike, just south of Portland, known as Crosby Farm. It's 06:30. Crosby Farm is swarming with police cars and other vehicles. It's a brisk morning. Nice sky, but cloudy. Snow's predicted for later. A big smile from Lieutenant Dorian lifts my spirits. We've got a lot riding on this, but so does he. This is his baby. I go up to the command post and situation room on the second floor. These guys are organized, and it's an elaborate operation. The computer search program is set up, and one of the wardens is explaining how it will coordinate the areas and maps. Through the window, I see people gathering. News teams are starting to show up. Tom, Matt, Scott, Danny, Dorian, Gay, and others cram into the room to go over the plan. Everyone is focused, hopeful, as Dorian goes over the procedures. Matt looks weary, and as always, serious. "Hey, Sarge," I slap his back. "We're going to do it today. Let's get ready for the news." Diane and her good friend Lucille are climbing out of cars. Lucille has been such a supportive friend. Diane looks tired and painfully sad. It's so hard for her to keep going through this, but she's incredible, the way she holds up. We bring them inside and offer coffee and bagels, and yeah, there are donuts, too. The news crews are waiting. Sergeant Stewart, Lieutenant Dorian, Diane, and I stand before the cameras in a final appeal to the public to help us find Amy. It's cold, and I start off nervous. So much to remember. Always a tightrope to walk with the media, trying to ensure I include everyone and not compromise the operation. Today we are conducting a massive ground search with PPD, MSP, Warden Service, and Massar in hopes of finding Amy St. Laurent. There is an air wing, along with a helicopter, thanks to Mr. Sam Hamill of TCI Aircraft. We've scripted this. I know it, but it sounds stilted. I continue, trying to stave off the incoming inquiry. Based on our studies, we believe Amy could be in an area we have triangulated with the help of the Warden Service. We are not discussing any criteria concerning the selection of the sites, and one should not conclude that these are the only sites. Each time I pause, I see their mouths get ready to jump. In addition, we have up to 10 canine dogs helping in this intensive effort to find Amy. I turn it over to Diane. She pleads for any help or information, her voice strong but cracking at times from emotion. She has such grace, such dignity. We all want, more than anything, to ease some of her pain by finding her daughter. Amy has been gone for 7 weeks. Sergeant Stewart's speech is clear and succinct. Finally, Lieutenant Dorian steps up to explain the warden's perspective. I close with a final appeal for help and information about Amy. The questions flood us. Are you looking for a body? Is this guy who said he dropped her off connected to the search? Should the public be looking for a car or some item? We field the questions carefully. Finally, the reporters, cameras, and crew break away and pan the search groups as they move into a giant maintenance shed for briefing and assignments. Thorpe and Duma catch my eyes and roll theirs like this is crazy. I close my eyes a moment and pray. Cops, wardens, and search and rescue teams were packed into a big DOT garage as the warden's overhead team told them what they should be looking for. Searchers were given the information about Gorman's borrowing a shovel and alerted to the possibility that Amy might be buried. They were given copies of the flyer with Amy's picture, her description, and a description of what she was wearing the night she disappeared. Searchers were instructed to keep their eyes open, look for clues, and ask questions. The wardens reminded them that anything could be valuable information: bent twigs, scraped tree trunks, a thread, scrap of paper, disturbed dirt or vegetation, dirt mounded up or dirt caved in, shovel marks, piled brush that didn't look natural. As they went through the briefing, Sergeant Joyce remembered thinking, "Everyone else is home with their families today, and we're going to be out in the cold tromping through the woods." Getting things set up and ready to roll, the situation was best described as controlled chaos, something all the players, detectives, wardens, and search and rescue teams were familiar and comfortable with. It's amazing how emergency workers come together quickly when they need to. It was a massive operation, about which Sergeant Stewart noted, "Normally, you would have to pull hairs to get resources, but not this time. It really came together." Each team included state or Portland police and a warden, as well as the Massar volunteers. Each team got a map, a detailed set of instructions for its search area, and a GPS device so that the teams could start and end the searches at established points, and the overhead team could maintain a computer record of the areas searched. Things settled down as the teams rolled out the door to start their first round of searches. Overhead, Airwolf, Sam Hamill, was up in his helicopter. With him were Portland detectives Mark Tesano and Don Creer, who would be conducting their own search from above. Despite his optimism, and he had mentally assigned a 40% or better chance that they'd find Amy that day, Kevin Adam recognized that the information about Gorman's borrowing the shovel would make things harder. The grousing Portland police detectives were right. It would not be like finding a needle in a haystack, but finding a needle buried in a haystack. On his personal timeline, he thought that if they didn't find her by 11, he'd start to worry. To prevent information from leaking out to the media monitoring the airwaves, the police and wardens had chosen to use the phrase "code blue" if a body was located. Scott Heracles began every day with a prayer. He never asked God for help, because he believed God helps those who help themselves. But on this day, he got down on his knees and asked God for help in finding Amy. When he and Danny Young met up, Scott told Danny, "We're going to find her today." Danny Young responded, "Yes, I know," and even gave Scott a time. He told Scott he felt really good about the prospects, very optimistic. They had so much help with the search, and all the areas they were searching were associated with Gorman. Young and Heracles didn't join a search team, but traveled together in a car, staying mobile and on call in case a body or associated evidence was found. Since they had the time, they asked each other, "Okay, so where have you always wanted to look?" Unable to stay still, they were independently searching the woods between the Westbrook Arterial Highway and the Bill Dodge auto dealership, which Gorman was familiar with because of his employment at Bill Dodge. Since getting the case, the two primaries had been working steadily, days, nights, and even weekends. But it was the holiday season. Young had made plans with his wife for the next day, Sunday, and was looking forward to finally having a day off. Throughout the morning, as the search teams worked through the sites on their maps, the dogs repeatedly hit on things. Each time the search would halt to determine if the discovery was significant. The airwaves sang with reports that turned out to be false alarms: dead animals, bad smells, a floating tarp, bones, deer parts. All had to be taken seriously. Like an erratic EKG, the mood was episodic excitement followed by depression or downright hopelessness. In the midst of the morning searches, the wardens discovered there had been a glitch in the morning's dog search of the area surrounding some small ponds on a narrow tote road off Route 22, not far from Gorman's mother's house. The wardens determined to send both a search group and some dogs back into that area as soon as a team became available. After the teams went out, Diane and Lucille visited the wardens in their command center. Diane was asking questions about the techniques of the search and the mapping technology the wardens were using to track the search results. Pinned up on the wall was a large map of the search area, with significant sites such as Gorman's mother's house and the site of the 3:14 a.m. traffic stop prominently marked. Lucille studied the map and asked about the significance of the Westbrook traffic stop site. Knowing that the police were keeping this information secret, the wardens invented an explanation. Unsatisfied and still suspicious, she asked Lieutenant Laughlin about the mark on the map as well. But no one was ready to reveal this valuable piece of information. It was a card the police wanted to hold close to their chests. It was well past the 11 a.m. deadline Kevin Adam had mentally assigned. They had had a series of false alarms. It was cold, and it was hard to keep the team's spirits up as they finished the lunch the Salvation Army food truck had provided and set out for their afternoon's assignments. It was also hard to balance the necessity of executing each search in a slow and methodical way with the sense of urgency imposed by the threat of approaching snow. At approximately 1 p.m., a search team led by Warden Justin Fowley and including Portland Detective Gary Thorpe and members of the Mahoosick Mountain SAR team arrived to begin their search of an old, grown-up road extending approximately 200 yards off Route 22. The road had been used to obtain the gravel needed to build I-295. Its surface was crumbling tar, and the road and surrounding woods were choked with trash, brush, and debris people had dumped there. The road was bordered with scrub trees, thin birches, and small pines. At the end of the road, trails led off into the brush and circled around four small black ponds. It was an area popular with local hunters and fishermen. At its end, facing the road and peering through the trees like a lurking monster, was the carcass of a large abandoned truck. Scattered around it were the large white wooden forms contractors used for pouring foundations. The Mahoosick team had come into the operation in a skeptical frame of mind, feeling that searching for a body wasn't part of their work. It wasn't what they were trained to do. The Mahoosick Mountain SAR always looked for live people. But inspired by Lieutenant Pat Dorian's enthusiasm and certainty that it would be a good thing to use their expertise to assist state and Portland police, they had joined the effort. They knew that everybody was looking for signs of a crime scene or a dumped, decomposing body, possibly hidden by brush or leaves. In the morning, they had also been instructed that there might be a grave. Their team had already been out in the December cold for several hours. Now they gathered again to get their instructions for this site. Mindful of their instructions, their breath forming clouds in piercingly damp air that increasingly held the promise of snow, the searchers spread out in a line from the edge of Route 22 at approximately 7-foot intervals and began their slow, deliberate march along the left side of the old tote road, through the tangle of underbrush and young trees. They were all aware that this afternoon's search would probably be the last chance to look for Amy St. Laurent until spring. The team reached the end of the road, moved farther left, and made their way back out to Route 22. Then they switched to the right side of the road, slowly and deliberately paying close attention to the woods around them and the ground beneath their feet. They paced their way from Route 22 back toward the ponds. At 1:30, just about 25 yards from the end of the road, they entered an area that alternated between open ground and pasture pines, pine trees with low branches that spread widely at the bottom. As he bent to go under a large branch, Landon Fake, an administrator with the Hurricane Island Outward Bound School, noticed that the soil just in front of him looked slightly depressed. Pine needles were scattered over ground that appeared to have been disturbed. He stopped, announced that he had found something, and knelt to examine the ground. When he looked more closely, he could see that one of the live branches of the pine tree was buried in the ground. It immediately made him stop and think, Someone has been digging here recently. Fake's announcement immediately stopped the line. Everyone came over, looked, and agreed that he had found something. Closer examination revealed shovel marks and an area of disturbed ground approximately 6 to 7 feet in diameter. The disturbed ground was topped by sod that had been cut into pieces at one time. Brown pine needles had been sprinkled over the dirt to mask the signs of digging. Portland Detective Gary Thorpe, who was with the search team, acknowledged that he wasn't an expert on outdoor crime scenes. "Put me in any building, at any room at a crime scene," he'd say, "and I know what's going on. Out here, I don't know a lot. But when I looked at what Fake was pointing out, even I knew that something was wrong." Thorpe looked at live green pine needles buried in the earth and thought, "Oh yeah, you're going to hear a code blue on this one." Thorpe called on his radio for dogs to search the area. A call was also made to Detectives Young and Heracles, summoning them to the site. When he got the call, Young told himself, "This is it." The Mahoosic Mountain SAR team was immediately moved out and sent to another site. As Landon Fake said, "They couldn't get us out of there fast enough. In 2 minutes, we were gone." Out at the road, waiting to leave, they saw cars of senior police personnel arrive, along with the dog truck. Warden Burnell and two volunteers brought in their dogs. The first dog didn't react well. The second dog reacted hard and began to dig. Warden Jacobs was called to bring in his dog. His dog also reacted and began to dig. At around 2:30, the wardens called Warden Sergeant Roger Gay and his dog Reba to the site. Reba first focused on an area under some pine trees and then on the area of disturbed earth Fake had discovered. A prickle of excitement went through the dozen men and women standing around in weeds and scrub on a cold gray December afternoon. After a day of false alarms and 7 weeks of high expectations but negative results, everyone was afraid to hope that this was finally it. Young, who like Sergeant Joyce had begun his day thinking, "Hey, this sucks, it's colder than hell and we're out here in the woods," had been working toward this moment since the first night he got the phone call about Amy's disappearance. Afraid to believe this might finally be what they had searched for so long, the detectives asked if this was likely to be a body, or might just be buried clothes, or another dead animal. Sergeant Gay assured them that Reba's reaction meant they'd likely found a body. Not wanting to call a code blue too soon, and knowing that they'd found many dead animal parts already, Detective Young returned to his car and got some tools from the trunk. He returned to the scene and pulled on gloves. On his knees, using a trowel, digging very carefully to avoid disturbing any evidence if it was Amy, he dug a small test hole, about 4 to 6 inches wide, at the opposite end of the site from where Reba had been digging. Approximately 2 feet down, he hit something that felt different from the soil. He cleared the dirt, exposing a small expanse of gray material. He reached into the hole and touched it, confirming that it was sweatshirt fabric. Amy St. Laurent had been wearing a sweatshirt the night she disappeared. At 2:40, Young called a code blue, and the site became a crime scene. At 2:41, the search teams were recalled to Crosby Farm. As the search teams set out, Lieutenant Dorian shouts one final message. "If you discover anything, call out code blue over the radio so the news or scanner land doesn't pick up and we'll get the dogs there. In a hospitable spirit, we also have food available. I plan to roam to various sites and check in at headquarters. Right now, I'm very glad to be inside where it's warm." Within an hour, there's a hit in an area near where Gorman was stopped by Westbrook police. It makes sense, and I think, "Oh my God, what if it's her?" But a short time later, they call that it's a dead deer. A huge letdown. Time to get out there and poke around with the teams. I watch one group probe the woods, moving in a line through the trees. There's another false alarm, a dead dog. A few more false alarms come in during the morning and into the afternoon. I go to 109 around 1300, have lunch, and update Deputy Chief Burton and the Chief. Tommy, Danny, and I have been on the phone on and off, but I haven't heard from them for a while. Around 1430, I'm starting to lose faith. I head outbound on Congress toward Route 22, where I know they're starting to search near Gorman's mother's house. Suddenly, my pager starts beeping like crazy. It's Tommy. I think he must want food for the guys. It beeps again. Okay, Tommy, okay. I get on the phone and hear Tom's voice. Joe, we found her. Really? It floats in the air. Really, Tom? I'm telling you again, Joe. We found Amy. Where, Tom? Where? I hear voices in the background, dogs barking. Are you sure? We're off a short tote road off 22 near the mom's house. Danny's here. The dogs hit hard. Get out here, Joe. It looks like a grave. I hardly believe what I just heard. I drive hastily to the scene, still in disbelief. It's colder, the sky bruised and cloudy with a curious light. I'm shouting in my car for other cars to move out of my way, still not believing. Maybe it's just her clothes. Out of Portland, I drive past Smiling Hill Farm and spot numerous police and warden vehicles in the distance, their emergency flashers on. Dispatch is paging me. I tell the operator to tell the news media that we're still searching and conducting a meeting to make more plans, hence all the cars. I pull off onto the dirt shoulder. It's all woods and unfamiliar territory. Officers and wardens out by the road say, "Lieutenant, they're up this road about 200 yards. You'll see them." I feel the weight of it as I move up the road, through the skeletal wood, a gray landscape, bleak as a Goya painting. Will this be her, damn it? Will it? Will we finally have something to tell Diane? I see a group, and yeah, there's Dorian, looking at me with a big hillbilly smile. My stomach flips. It's really true, I think. It's really true. Tommy walks jerkily up to me. I grab his arms and look at him. It's her, Joe. Danny next. I hug Danny. His eyes are moist, and I feel my own getting cloudy and hot. 7 weeks he's worked toward this moment. Danny, oh God, Dan, great job. Dogs are probing the woods. There's a bustle of activity. I start noticing other people around me. Matt, Scott, Roger Gay with Reba, that friendly red-headed warden. They lead me through the brush, ducking branches into the woods about 50 feet. A branch snaps into my thigh, the sharp sting saying, "This is real. This is real." I smell dirt and see the outline of a grave. There's a small hole, and Danny explains how he dug down until he felt something in his probe about 2 feet in. It was Amy, her gray sweatshirt. I peer into the hole and see the sweatshirt. I turn and look at Danny. Imagine him digging with his fingers and actually touching Amy. I rise, feeling thrilled, sad, troubled. "Roger," I ask Gay. "What if it's just her clothes?" Gay and Dorian assure me. The way the dogs hit, it's a body. Buried. I think, buried? How? Buried alive? Strangled? Stabbed? Shot? What are we going to find? The Rolodex of crime scenes starts. Finding what they hoped would be Amy St. Lawrence's burial site was nothing short of a miracle. Murderers rarely take the time to bury a body. They may shroud a body with brush or leaves, but usually they want to get away from what they've done as quickly as possible. For more than a month, everyone has been searching for a dumped body or a hidden body. Naturally, they'd been alert to signs of recent digging, but mostly they had been looking above ground. Luckily, the wardens had asked their question about connecting Gorman to a shovel. Even more luckily, the detectives had gotten an honest answer to that question. Amy St. Lawrence's suspected grave was located less than 0.4 miles behind Gorman's mother's house. And without Lieutenant Pat Dorian and Massar, it probably never would have been found. Chapter 12. Everyone was eager to get on with the work of getting Amy out of the ground. The small glimpse of gray sweatshirt Danny Young's digging had revealed had brought tears and a heartbreaking mixture of excitement and profound sorrow. But while Danny Young and Scott Heracles might have wanted to just grab some shovels and start digging, and all the officers would have liked to get inside out of the seeping cold, none of them, having come this far, wanted to take a chance on losing the evidence or information the burial site might give them by moving too quickly. They knew what they had to do. It was only weeks away from the shortest day of the year. The weary detectives had no time, in the fading gray light of a December afternoon, to do much more than pat each other on the back and shake the grinning warden's hands before turning their attention to the complexities of converting a major search operation into a crime scene requiring the meticulous exhumation of a buried body. Young said it was as though the minute they found her gravesite, time slowed down. Another time, another season, they might have discussed securing the outdoor scene and coming back in the morning. It is always best to work an outdoor crime scene in daylight. But snow was coming, and a December snow in Maine might still be on the ground in April. The detectives couldn't risk losing days or weeks with their evidence buried. Even if a tarp might have protected the gravesite itself and not collapsed under the weight of snow, the surrounding area as well as the access road needed to be carefully searched, and the investigators couldn't cover all that with tarps. They had already lost many weeks during which valuable evidence was being destroyed. They were also running on an adrenaline high fueled by their sheer amazement at having found Amy's grave, so no one wanted to stop. Everyone wanted to finish the job. They wanted to bring Amy home. As civilian personnel was released, it was critical to make sure they understood that no information about what had been found and what police were working on could be released to anyone, not to family or friends, and, most critically, not to the media. The Mahoosic Mountain searchers were pulled aside back at Crosby Farm and told, in cop speak, that there had been a significant find. Their names were taken in case they would be needed later to appear at a trial, and they were released with profound thanks. As the story unfolded, the Mahoosic team could see that, however reluctantly they had come into the search, their expertise had made a difference, and it had been worth doing for Amy's family. Those in command also moved quickly through the business of thanking and dismissing the police personnel who had helped with the search, many of whom wanted to stick around and have a piece of the action. But everyone knew that crime scene processing worked better with a small, efficient crew. There would be some bruised egos and hurt feelings, but there wasn't time to worry about it. There was way too much to be done. As Lieutenant Laughlin put it, "You feel bad, but you're already moving on, and they've got to understand it's just part of the job." Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We are reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.